My name is Holly Lessig.
My name is Jess Wolf, and we're Lucius.
So I'm going to fill in a lot of blanks. Let's see. We got your first album in 2013, but you've been singing together for 11 years. You're named after the Bulldog. You went to Berkeley, which we're going to circle back to because I went to grad school in Boston. You named the album after Charlie Brown's favorite thing that he says.
It wasn't intentional. Didn't even think about it until after.
It was intentional, but not intentionally after Charlie Brown.
Right. It's amazing how, as songwriters, in two words, you can sum up everything you wanted to say, but then it takes all those other words to expand upon it, right? So when you did come upon it, where was the trajectory that you actually named it in relation to the songs? You didn't go, oh, we're going to name it Good Grief and we're going to write some songs around that. Where in the trajectory of this record did that come up?
We had written some pretty heavy songs and we were needing some relief for the songs.
You think those are heavy songs, huh? I was listening here and I was smiling.
And I think at some point we're like, gosh, we got to write some songs to give our listeners a breath and to give ourselves a breath. I mean, we can't just be talking about heartache and difficulties. And then at some point we were thinking about the juxtaposition between these two, you know, sort of lines we were drawing in our record. And it just made sense. We were thinking about names, and at some point, you know, I mean, literally writing down a list, and at some point I was just like, well, what about Good Grief? And not just because the sort of, you know, declaration, Good Grief, and what that implies, but also the idea that there is good in grief.
I mean, if you're touring 300 days a year, right? And you and the fact is that rock and roll is weekends, right? You're not taking weekends off. In fact, weekends are pretty much where you're working. The Friday, Saturday is the thing. You're working harder than a CEO, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's my point, is if you're doing 300 days, even like CEOs of companies in this day and age who work 16-hour, 20-hour days, you've got them beat.
Yeah. Well, it was funny because when she was just talking about the gift of song, we have the gift of song to be able to express the grief. I was thinking, yeah, but part of the grief is because of the curse of song, you know, because we have, you know, this ability and this yearning to make music and, you know, we're on the road for this long and it makes this impact on your life. And so it's kind of like both. It's like,
I was also just talking to a friend and we were expressing sort of the need for grief in a sense. Like we need that in order to find some inspiration, you know, in parts of our lives. Yeah. Like sometimes you rely on putting yourself in a situation where you know might be difficult in order to get something from it, even if it's subconscious.
The transition, I'll do it in the full announcer voice. The transition from being a duo to being a true band. See, it's right there.
Oh, nice.
See, number right there, number four, kind of scary, right? But I mean, there's interesting things about duos. I mean, and again, I'm dating myself, but Sonny and Cher, Simon and Garfunkel. So what I'm interested in, again, and this is going to become a theme, but where was the sea change where you turn to each other and go, you know, we love each other, we've been around forever, we have to be together, we're best friends, we don't really fight, which is unfortunate for us because there's not a lot of good front page of the Tattler kind of thing because we actually like each other. But we really do want to add to this, and I'm imagining it wasn't for show, it was for you too, that you felt a need to do it. Not just for company, but for other things. So where was the sea change where you kind of looked at each other and said, okay, we've always sort of been, two people can be a band, but more people can make us more.
I think we wanted to feel like an ultimate support, and I think we wanted to find other ways to collaborate and to see what could come of what the two of us, I think we have the best of both worlds, to answer your question. Like, I think we are a duo. We're a duo when we write songs. We're a duo in business together, as friends. I mean, we do a lot of things, just the two of us, singing with other people. Yes. And then when we can bring what we write to a group of seriously talented guys and see what how they can bring what we do to life. I don't know, there's a whole nother joy seeing it outside of yourself, seeing how somebody can make more from what you give.
That's the ultimate test to the music, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you need the song first and foremost.
That helps.
No, that's it, I think. For the most part, I think if you have a great song, anything, the world is your oyster, you know?
So we'll get to the producers in a second, but tell me, as you were writing these songs, what was in your head as far as the sound? Did you have things that you talked about as you were writing them, or did you have no idea, and it was just like, we're concentrating on the songs and we'll figure it out later?
I think for some of them, we had ideas, and, you know, we... Jess and I did a lot of demos on GarageBand and kind of lo-fi stuff. And if we had specific arrangement ideas, we would either basically make scratch tracks of either a synth or even use our vocals to arrange horn, like kind of string parts or horn parts or whatever it was. And then some of them we left pretty bare bones because we knew, like she was saying, how much the guys would contribute and how much fun we would have in the studio kind of experimenting. And we did. I mean, we referenced a lot of music. We listened to a lot of music in the studio all together and picked out different textures and different moments and things that we wanted to incorporate into the songs. So I think a lot of that came afterwards.
Sean and Bob, them's two different guys. Mm-hmm. So first, how'd you choose them? And two, how do you get to the hole on a record with two disparate guys like that?
You know, well, firstly, they had worked together before on a strange record in Italy at some point in the past.
Thank you for this, because this is where I'm trying to get to, because nobody knows this.
Oh, yeah. So I don't remember what the record was, but it was an orchestral record. And so they had a relationship. It wasn't just totally random. But we liked the idea when we thought, what about doing this? Sean was already a very dear friend of ours and mixed our last record, Wild Woman,
yes.
And lived close to us and was excited about the idea of working. And then we thought, well, what about bringing in somebody who is from sort of like the complete end of the spectrum? You know, where Sean's this like mad scientist, really like... couldn't be more creative, couldn't be a sort of a wilder sonic man. Bob's kind of the doctor, you know? So I think how it ended up working is that Bob came in for the pre-production, worked with us on sort of picking out the songs and making some notes on how we could improve going into the studio, and then I would say like 95% of the record was made with Sean on his own.
We knew that Sean's such a wild sound guy, and we kind of relied on that fact that he was going to really bring it sonically to a whole nother place. So.
Taking rock and roll beyond jeans. How's that? That's like your headline. They took rock and roll beyond the jeans. But the idea of symmetry is really kind of fascinating to me because, you know, done really well, you know, it allows you to be fantastical, not just fantastic. Putting all this stuff together, whether it's the visuals for the show, whether it's the wigs, whether it's the costumes, whether it's the symmetry, all of that, It's more about the big picture for you that you kind of wake up in the morning and go, how can we continue to make this fantastic so we continue to surprise? Am I on the right path here?
Sure. I mean, constantly trying to create a landscape to excite ourselves and to bring people into, you know, a different world. I grew up in the theater, so for me I was always drawn to being swept away by a performance or by a feeling or by a song. And I think that we both connected on being inspired by artists who did a similar, had a similar approach with their music, you know, visual landscape alongside their sonic landscape.
So Los Angeles is kind of opened up a whole new, a wide new berth, is it not?
It's a lot different than when I was a kid. It's much more cultural, much more
amazing.
Yeah, it's bustling, you know. I mean, there's definitely a vibrancy that didn't exist when I was a kid. And so many of our friends and much of our community from New York has moved out of New York.
A massive amount. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, there was a New York Times article about the mass exodus.
Yes. Yes.
So it's been a really nurturing environment. And also, because it's so spread out and because there's so many little, like, nooks, I think we're able to relax.
Oh, what a concept.
What a concept, coming home from the road and needing a little bit of space and maybe go take a hike, yeah. You know, 5-minute drive to Griffith Park or whatever it is. It's just, it's really lovely.
The songs that are the best songs in the world, in my book, I love the songs that are candy-coated on the outside. They're melodic, they're beautiful, they're well-produced, and then you get to the dark, chewy, gooey stuff on the inside. And as right, and as you're listening, you're like, this is beautiful, this is beautiful. Whoa, wait a minute. Now, these came out of your heart and soul because of all this time on the road. But now that you look back on it and you think about it and you think about the Tootsie Roll Pop, is this, you know, does it all feel like it's candy coated again as you're continuing to wallow? And I don't mean wallow in a bad way, but this is what you wrote is your life. But most people are licking that Tootsie Roll Pop and they get to the dark, gooey part and they don't really realize what's inside. So tell me about that.
Right. Most people don't initially find the sort of heart of the song. They listen to the melody.
They don't take the time to get through the candy coating.
Right. The melody, the rhythm, the production. I think we ourselves, when we first write a song, it's so personal and so sort of precise that once we put it out into the ether, it sort of becomes everybody else's, right? And then you sort of listen to it with a different set of ears. You sort of approach it with a different intent almost, you know? Mm-hmm. Or at least that's what keeps it fresh. Like the, I think each of these songs have changed for me having sung them hundreds of times at this point, you know? I think that the, not the root of it, but depending on the day or depending on the city or depending on who we're around or who it's affecting and how you can feel that energy from the crowd, I think that you can be carried by a feeling in a different way, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I'm excited by that. I like the idea that it doesn't have to remain the same. Maybe in the beginning it does because you're trying to get in a routine and rehearse it a certain way and have it pretty locked down so that you can then be free with it. But that, you know, it's an interesting thing that Go Home we've sung, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times and it still feels fresh to me because we're in front of a different crowd in a different place and depending on the day, maybe it means something different to me, or maybe I am feeling something from you, you know, across the stage, and that bounces back to me, and I feel it in a different way.
So, because it is so personal, there's always concern: will the audience come along? In the end, though, there's really no choice, right? Because you made a decision, the audience kind of has to come along.
Yeah, I think people naturally do come along the ride when things are so honest. Like, that's the thing that kind of catches people's attention. I mean, that's the thing that catches my attention with other artists is when I can feel like, whoa, that's really something I could relate to, or that you know that person's telling something true. Or making up a story that, it can be fictional too. Songs can be fictional too, of course, but like it's coming from somewhere, mm-hmm. somewhere honest first, you know, before anything else. And so I think that people sense that and do go along for the journey.
So they decided to leave the happy cocoon of their earlier recording and went into the dark side, right? And they're using that as the focus and the ballast for what they were talking about. Do you just kind of say, well, you know what? We're just going to keep fooling you because this is about us and this is human. And guess what? It's going to go where it goes.
Yeah, I mean, that's life. I mean, it doesn't really matter what they think or say. I mean, that's just life. You have ups and downs. And so we're writing about our life. So I think that's very normal and human thing.
Not everybody gets it because not everybody has partners. Not everybody has husbands. Not everybody has that as a, you know, as a responsibility.
I think lucky for us, at least, people really connect to our songs regardless of their story. I think that there's the types of songs that can take on different sort of roles, you know, can fill in the blanks for somebody's own personal experience. And I think that's why we have so many really committed fans. Yeah. I mean, we're really fortunate to have so many sort of committed fans.
So I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich, and here is what it is. It's two of your songs on the outside, and then songs by anybody else in between. And